Good afternoon. I call together our Commerce Committee meeting for February 5th, 2019. A quorum is present, so has somebody on the committee had a chance to review the minutes, and are you willing to offer a motion for approval?
Madam Chair, so moved. Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
Okay, then yes, so moved. Approval of the minutes, I'm sorry, for January 30th.
Representative Dean moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Dean, I'm sure you're never going to question my CLA's coning again.
Madam Chair, the only reason I ask that is I started a committee once without a fault.
Lessons from the field. I appreciate that. Thank you. Well, today is, I think, our final overview for a while. Appreciate you all being here today. Today we're going to talk about gambling in Minnesota, and would like to start by hearing from Tom Barrett from the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. Welcome to the committee. And I know that you have a PowerPoint presentation. We'll let you get that up and running.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And speaking of running, Mr. Barrett came over from the Senate. Last on the agenda there, first on the agenda here, so. I know. It's a good fitness plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board and appreciate the opportunity to come before you, give hopefully what will be a brief overview, and then turn it over to our counterparts with the lottery and the Racing Commission as well. But a little pride that we get to go first, I think, because we're the biggest. No. Briefly, the board's mission is two-point. One, obviously maintain the integrity of all the operations. That involves who's playing the games, who's providing the games, and how they're conducted. And ultimately, the second point is getting money to the bottom line, which is what charitable gaming is all about. So pretty simple in that respect. With regards to who regulates, right now the board is made up of seven citizens. Five are appointed by the governor. One is appointed by the Attorney General, and one is appointed by the Commissioner of Public Safety. I have 32 great staff, 32 I emphasize because, well, charitable gaming in Minnesota is the largest in the country here. It's one of the smallest when it comes to regulation. We're split up in four units, licensing. Anybody's got their hands on the product in terms of selling, making, manufacturing. They all go through licensing, background check process. We have our compliance and audit section. That's by far the biggest makeup of our 32 staff, but they're the ones that are doing the audits, the site inspections, writing up reports in terms of any findings. We have investigations, whether it comes from our audits and our findings, or if we get allegations from players or ex-spouses that want to turn in a spouse. But we get a number of, it's true, one of our best informants are ex-spouses. But we do have a formal investigative unit that will go out, whether we work cooperatively with our folks from public safety when we think it's criminal in terms of hidden cameras or confronting that aspect. And then finally, administration, all of myself and two other staff. Relatively small, but that is the detail when it comes to the Gambling Control Board. How do we regulate? Like I said, licensing. Anybody that has their hands on the products, that's the nonprofits, the vendors that are providing the games, the distributors, gambling managers, as well as the sales locations. We educate, we train, we try to mentor when we need to if there's a sudden change in gambling managers. And we've launched this last fiscal year, the first time, quite successful, an online training, really saving our staff some time, but also saving the charities money when it comes to travel. We do still offer human training around the state, but we found it's really been beneficial, those folks that want to keep up on the latest changes, to go online. Approving and testing games, tremendous volume. On average, over 500 new games every month that are coming out of the Gambling Control Board. All those games are tested and reviewed before they hit the streets. But that's over 6,300 games a year, tremendous volume. And as I had mentioned, conducting regulatory audits, site inspections. And as a last resort, we do have the power in law to issue fines, suspensions, revocations. If we can't get their attention one way, It goes back to the mission, the integrity of the operations. Industry to regulate, 2,800 sites, primarily bars, VFW, Legion posts, 1,100 licensed charitable organizations. Each one of those are required to put forward one of their members to be a gambling manager, go through the training, go through the licensing, but that's the point person that is responsible for all things relative to their gambling operation in terms of reporting. They can hire consultants or accountants, but we do focus all our attention on the gambling manager as well as the CEO or the post commander in terms of running a good operation. 3,400 exempt and excluded permits. We think of those as relatively small raffles, the church raffles that, you know, exceed a certain limit. The value of those exempt activity raffles was over $36 million last fiscal year. Tremendous volume in that sense. And we have 11 manufacturers, 2 Link Bingo providers, 9 distributors, and right now 98 distributor salespersons are out making sales to the sites. So that gives you kind of an indication of the numbers that are coming under our radar. What is lawful gambling? 5 forms, pull tabs, both paper and electronic, tip boards, paddle wheels, bingo, and then raffles. One of the hearings over the Senate question was asked, paddle wheels, is that the riverboat gambling? No, it's the Wheel of Fortune, the simple thing that we've heard a lot about in local bars, the meat raffles that spin the wheel. So that's what it is. Other gambling, by virtue of our name, the Gambling Control Board, we do get calls. You know, this slot machine wasn't paying out like it should, or the lottery game. So we work very closely with our counterparts, both the tribal side, the lottery, the horse racing, as well as the Department of Public Safety when it comes to things that we might find in the course of an audit or inspection, things that could be illegal and criminal. Our authority stops at the civil side, but unfortunately we do get into cases where we find of criminal nature, and we work very close with the folks of public safety. But I point out here, while we work together, we have no say over that operation. Industry numbers, $2 billion. This is the 9th year in a row that charitable gaming sales have increased or gone up. Like I said, Minnesota ranks number one in the country in terms of sales activity. We're one of the smallest when it comes to regulation. That's a credit to you all and others in terms of the laws that are on the books. We have our friends across the river in Wisconsin coming to visit us in 2 weeks. They want to know, how does Minnesota do what they do in terms of getting money for the charities? So that's a good example where I think what's working.
Don't tell them.
They got a long way to go, but no. The majority goes back in terms of prizes to the players. What's left, charities, they had last year about $83 million to fund their missions. That doesn't count their expenses. That was about $156 million. $75.1 million in taxes, depending upon the time of the year. Yeah, we'll get into some of the issues. We certainly know taxes are a concern. There's a few bills already proposed. But that's what was paid. While $2 billion is a record, $75 million is also a record in terms of receipts going to the state. And then our regulatory budget of $3.4 million. We are funded from the fees we collect from the industry we regulate. Those funds go into a dedicated account. We receive no general fund. While that being said, if we had extra like we did last fiscal year, this is we're into the second year of the biennium, we don't anticipate to spend that. We're going to stay with what you appropriated. So the balance of the excess funds are going back to the dedicated fund to be appropriated another day. Where's the money go? A simple graphic, but for every dollar wagered, again, approximately 84% goes back to the player in the way of prizes. Expenses, a little, almost 8% for the charities, paying their compensation, paying the bar owner's rent, paying the vendors for the product. What's available, a little over 4%. State tax, again, about almost 4% in that. And then that very thin line, if you can see that, but that's what we retain for our regulatory budget, pretty small. Over the years, since 1985, when the state officially recognized charitable gaming to be under state control, we know bingo was going on well back in the World War II days and the like. But you can see how the flow of the activity has taken place over the number of years. The big dip you see in roughly the 2007 era, that was pretty much the impact of the smoking ban that took effect statewide, as well as the change in the economy. But obviously now the economy, I think everybody's accepted the smoking ban for what it is, but we do see a rise happening, benefiting those charities that are involved in charitable gaming. another simple graphic, but we said pull tabs makes up the bread and butter. And with that said, you know, bingo at $90 million, while it's a small on the bar chart, that's still $90 million of activity that's taking place in bingo. So it all adds up. Expenses by category. This is not the gambling control budget, but it's the cumulative budgets of all the licensed charities. So as you can see, approximately $62 million went to pay compensation for the people that are selling the products. The gambling products coming from the vendors, charities spent upwards of $44 million on the products. And then rent. Rent is in the form of compensation to the bar owners for allowing the charity to take up a little space or selling the products behind the booth. But you can look at $31 million went to bar owners to compensate them for their activity allowing charities at the bars. Taxes, the only, again, the board's neutral on the taxes, but we know it's an issue, but this is simply a graphic illustration of the distribution of the taxes. The more the charity makes in the way of receipts from gambling, the higher the rate. So the majority, as you can see, the breakout, 481 are paying approximately, well, a little less than 10% of annually of their sales. But when you get down to that last 84 and they're in the higher bracket, obviously that the amount of taxes they're paying in the state pays it. So the concern I throw out for your consideration as you look at tax reform or changes, it's going to be tough to balance, keep winners and losers out there in terms of adjusting this formula. Does anybody want to pay taxes? No, we understand that. But we do offer some regulatory insight as it relates to potential impact of one version or another and how that would affect the charities. But this is just a graphic illustration that not all are paying the top rate, but certainly not all are paying the lower rate either. A lot of questions over the last few years as it involves electronic poll tabs. As you can see early on, calendar year 12, 13, 14, which I called in the Senate the foo-foo dust, we were accused with our original projections of creating these exorbitant estimates, but what we underestimated was the acceptance of the industry of this new format. Now that we've seen the new format in place and certainly some regulatory benefits of keeping track of these games that are out there in the street, you know, we've had some bars that, geez, miraculously they're open till 3 in the morning. Well, these electronics, they're not open at 3 in the morning, but they're still playing. These machines, they do shut down at a specific time, and everything gets cut off. We see the advantage of electronic reporting, but my point here is just, as we took our lumps early with the projections, the acceptance of the industry is now starting to take off. Issues and concerns. Mentioned briefly the tax rate, the tax structure. We know there's a few bills in play. Happy to provide any insight, but we remain neutral, but it would have an impact depending upon what ultimately gets decided. Sports wagering, hot topic. I think the point making here is, as regulators of charitable gaming industry, anything related to sports wagering or the opportunity could have an impact on the industry we regulate. So with that said, as discussions progress or the variety of choices as it relates to sports wagering, it's simply the board is interested of any potential impact on the charities that are conducting that. Issues from the board's perspective. Again, I mentioned $2 billion. Right now, that's all cash. We certainly understand that the marketplace is shifting away from cash, but by law, if you want to participate in charitable gaming, you need the cash. With the minor exception of raffles, there is a provision that you can write a check or use a debit card, but relatively small. But as it relates to the big business, it's all cash. Regulatory-wise, the simple concern is the volume of cash that's out there at these bars. Knock on wood, of a $2 billion industry, relatively small examples or cases of theft or robberies involving charitable gaming activity. But it's a concern. But more so, I think, as any of the marketplaces changing, the issue of cash debit card. And by not proposing, it's just an issue we're starting to hear out there in the industry. Aging veterans. We all know the veterans are getting up there, and we see a number of consolidation between VFW and Legion posts. It's just an issue because they make up approximately 27% of all licensed sites in Minnesota. So as a veteran post changes, maybe another place opens up in the local community. But it is an issue in terms of just the benefits from charitable gaming helping the veterans organizations. in terms of keeping the lights on literally and the utilities. And then the lack of volunteers in the early days, you know, that's pretty much all we had was good volunteers working. But now, as we all know, I think it's tough to get people to volunteer. So in that respect, we see increasing expenses to the charities because if you want to stay in the business, they're not going to do it for free. We still have a number of orgs that, for the goodness of their heart, they're operating and doing it for the good of the mission of the charity. But we're seeing those volunteers drop. Looking ahead, sports-themed tip boards. Somebody said, well, there's no sports wager in Minnesota. There is. Very small, but part of the 2012 legislation that was passed did allow for provision of sports-themed tip boards. Tip boards are one of the five forms that are currently allowed. The board did not move on that, even though they had the legislative and governor's approval, but with the blessing of the committee chairs back in the day, there was that federal law that prohibited other states other than the four to get involved in sports wagering. So the board took the position that we'll hold off approving any games related to sports wagering and wait for New Jersey that challenged the federal law. New Jersey prevailed. The Supreme Court ruled in favor, and that, as you've all heard, has opened it up for other states, including Minnesota. So the board went forward with approving a sports-themed tip board game, so it is legal in that respect right now, but none of the parimutuel or the sports book, the thing that you're hearing about. But when people say, is there sports wager in Minnesota, there is under charitable gaming, very small. Unfortunately, when the Vikings lost, so did some of the sales when we were launching it. But we'll anxious to see what the results are from last Sunday as relates to the Super Bowl and some of those games. But it's out there, legally approved, but relatively small. Link pull tab games, that's another thing that's come up in the industry as far as potential. It would require legislative approval. But right now, all pull tab games, be it paper or electronic, are focused at each site. So anybody that's at a Joe's Bar, they're playing from the game at Joe's Bar. But there's thought, geez, why don't we spread it out and have games played across? Well, could we regulate it? Yes. Is it legal? It's something that would have to come back to get approval to go beyond the scope of the site. But they're talking about it. And then finally, reduce fees. With the record sales happening, we'll be coming back when the budgets are released, but we plan to propose a slight fee reduction in the fee that we collect, simply because sales have been so good over the last few years. That's something that we hope to pass along to the industry that we're regulating. We also expect to see a reduction in fees from the manufacturers. There's some costs up front to get these electronic games and other things to market. Hopefully those things have settled down, and we would expect to see a reduction in those fees come from the vendors. But that's ultimately what would get passed on to the charities as well. So if I didn't talk too fast, but I thought I'd leave time for any questions. I did include in your packets some information, a sample newsletter that we send out to all licensed orgs, kind of give them the latest what's happening. But I think more important and good things to read at home is our annual report that really takes into account all the activity the last fiscal year and how things are going in terms of our efforts to regulate the industry.
Thank you for your presentation. We have a few questions. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Barrett. As you're giving your presentation, I began to think about, is there any funds through charitable gambling that goes to the prevention or addressing issues of gambling abuse or addiction? I know that some of our other forms of gambling sort of have a set dollar amount, and I haven't seen anything, and maybe I just haven't seen it. But if you could speak to that, that would be great.
Mr. Barrett.
Happy to. Madam Chair and Representative, yes, there is a portion of the taxes that are collected, and this comes through revenue. So while we report total taxes in our report, and maybe that's something we should include for the future, but there is a provision in law, and I believe the percentage is 0.1% of the taxes collected from charitable gaming are then made available to the Department of Human Services for a grant for the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance, I believe. So there's that provision. Charities are allowed under the law to donate freely to a problem gambling entity. Not as much, but there is that provision in there as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a question around the e-pull tab. Have you seen just a general growth in all gaming? when it comes to either paper or e, or has there just simply been a shift from paper to the e? And then my second question is, what's your budget? You didn't really talk. What's you're actually doing,
Mr. Barrett?
Madam Chair and Representative, our budget, real quick, is approximately $3.4 million. So it's the same level. Again, the official budget isn't out, but we're asking same level of funding. We aren't looking to change that in that respect. As relates to the forms, electronic pull tabs, all forms, all five forms, paper games, electronic pull tab games, bingo, raffle, tip boards, paddle wheels, all of them have shown an increase the last few years, and last year all went up. The biggest increase, though, I think, certainly focused on electronic, because that's still a new format that's still relatively new, even though it's number of years in play. But with the chart you saw with the rise, that's still less than half of the sites that could have it if they wanted it. So it's still getting out there, but all forms of charitable gaming have shown an increase.
Follow-up, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. And just one last, you kind of spoke about it's a cash-only, mostly business. Is there any move, and what would be the arguments against allowing using debit cards or credit cards other than people would do it more often?
Mr. Barrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, I think you said it right there, doing it more often or the convenience. Certainly a concern, and we know enough of the industry in terms of that problem side of you make that opportunity there. So we certainly, we only bring it up as an issue. It would take legislative, and I'm sure you would hear in that respect from others as well. But it's just one of those things that, do we stay the course, or does the industry stay the course? Regulatory-wise, again, our number one concern is just that cash exposure. There's a way to minimize that. We're going to do that regardless, but try to work with charities by monitoring what they have for cash banks at sites, just to minimize that risk as best we can. But that is a concern.
Thank you. Any more follow-up? Nope. Representative Listlegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a foolish question, but this is just mind-boggling to me to see $2 billion in gambling. And then I see $1.6 billion in prize payments. Is it thought that a lot of that $1.6 billion is part of the $2 billion because they take their winnings and they continue to gamble to get to the $2 billion? Or are we just that rich where we're just spending $2 billion?
Mr. Barrett.
Madam Chair, Representative. No, there is technical term, I guess, is the churn, where you win a dollar, and then, or you pay a dollar, you win 85 cents, 85 in. So it's that you win, you continue to play. You can cash out at any time or, again, get lucky. But it is that repetitive play based on the winnings.
Follow-up. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barrett, welcome, and appreciate you being here today. Always enlightening to see what's going on in the gaming in Minnesota. A follow-up on Representative Swazinski's comments and questions from earlier. You had commented that in your response that gaming in all areas, all five areas of the lottery type gaming, or the pull tab type gaming is increasing. Do you have a reason why, anecdotal or otherwise, why that might be increasing in the state of Minnesota? I think Representative Listlegard kind of hit on that as well. I guess I'd like to see if you have a little bit clearer reason or experiences from your time at gaming as to why that might be happening.
Mr. Barrett.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative, nothing certainly scientific. There's folks, economists or whatever, but certainly the economy, we hear that, and gas prices. When gas prices drop, there tends to be this discretionary income or more discretionary income available. Or the best month for sales, and again, the annual reports play this out, is March. And so we go, why March? I mean, is it this winter picked up demand get out or whatever, and then there's some thought, well, wait a minute, tax refunds are going. So there's I have no real answer other than when we get around the table and talk what's causing some of the increases. Good economy, low gas prices, and as I joked a little bit, people are out at the bars watching the Twins play or the Vikings, and then they lose. we see a little drop in activity. Now, is that associated because they couldn't get into the playoffs? Anybody from the Vikings here? but it's nothing scientific other than some obvious economy factors, I think, that are contributing.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I find that to be kind of interesting that we can actually have lower gas prices and increased revenues to the state without a increase in the gas tax. But that's maybe a different conversation for a different committee.
I think you're correct. I actually have a question. Can you tell us a little bit more about sports-themed tip boards? I'm going to show how much I gamble. I have no clue what that looks like or what that would be.
Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair. And again, don't want to take too much time, but it is a topic, and it's one that'll, I think, come back to this committee, mm-hmm. and we'll certainly engage our other counterparts on the side. So don't take mine for fact, but we've all the agencies have been working, looking at what's going on in other states since this Supreme Court decision to open it up. And it really, the very basic right now is our sports-themed tip boards. It's simply a little tip that, based on the outcome, the score of the game, you could win or lose. But from there, it could get into a whole cast of different methods, wagers, paramutual, right, or parlay. And that's where, maybe I'll speak directly to you. Others here might be familiar. You don't have to admit that because it's still illegal. But there's like a parlay type wagering where you get a series of games, you know, on a given Sunday, and you try to pick 4, 5, 10 winners. You have to win them all in order to win. That's similar in the sense of a pick six lottery type game. But the odds of winning that are impacted that you got to get them all right, as opposed to a sports book where this past Sunday with Super Bowl activity, tremendous activity going around the country, primarily Las Vegas, but wagers that are placed simply on the point spread of one particular game, the over, the under, the flip of the coin. There's so many different things that come into play when you talk of sports wagering, but it's primarily the simple tip boards, okay? Then they have the parlay type, get a number of games that you want to pick the winners correctly, and if you don't, you lose. If you do, you win. And then the sports book. Again, there's other resources here, be it our friends from public safety. We're constantly meeting on that, but we are looking at what's going on in other states, and it's all over the board in terms of regulation, who's involved, what games are allowed. The caution we'll throw, and you're going to hear about it, is that if states were to get involved in sports wagering, tremendous bank, tremendous risk if done incorrectly. So that's where some added cautions with the folks that have either learned from the experience or involved with it, and we're already learning some of the other states what they've jumped into. If you overtax it, they'll find the illegal route because there's better payoff, things like that. So it's for another day, but it's one of those topics that you all, I'm sure, you've heard about, and it takes a lot of good discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thanks for the presentation. I don't see any further questions now from the committee. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Robert Doty of the Minnesota Lottery. We'll let you get set up with your presentation. You're not the first person that asked about that today. Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Doty, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota State Lottery.
Welcome.
So again, thank you very much for having us today. At the lottery, I have the privilege of working with an extremely talented and dedicated staff. These 150 individuals work hard every day to ensure the lottery delivers for the state of Minnesota and for all of us as Minnesotans. Joining me today is Adam Prock, our Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs. Again, thank you for giving us the opportunity to provide your committee an overview and update of lottery operations. In 1988, Minnesota voters approved a constitutional amendment to create the Minnesota State Lottery. And it is not lost on anyone at the lottery that Minnesotans created the lottery to raise money for programs that benefit all of us. this charge is something we take very seriously, and you can see that in our mission and our vision. Since inception, lottery proceeds have exceeded $3 billion. These funds benefit Minnesotans in every corner of our state. And you can see the kind of breakdown there. The biggest recipient of those funds has really been the state's general fund and also the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Those are the two biggest recipients. So we have a slide of where does our money go, okay? As you can see on our slide, in fiscal 18, a full 92 cents of every dollar spent on lottery products was actually returned to Minnesotans. The vast majority of that, 62.2%, went toward prizes. And if you look at the center section there, those three segments there come up to about 13.5%, and that went to commissions for retailer partners, vendors, and operations. And then the last component there of that dollar, 25 cents basically, is for the state programs that we're going to talk a little bit about. But we work hard to maximize efficiencies and keep our operating costs very low. A Minnesota statute requires that lottery administrative costs must be below 9%. And I'm proud to report that in fiscal 18, we are well below that. And as you can see there, we're at 4.9%. So continuing along the lines of where does the money go, and specifically focused on that 25 cents of the dollar that goes to the state programs, after prizes and expenses, again, like I said, we have about 25 cents that go to the state. The biggest chunk of that goes to the state's general fund. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the other part, another big chunk goes to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. The remaining components go to other environmental-related funds. So the lottery has two types of products, scratch games and lotto games. So scratch or instant win games. These account for approximately 70% of lottery sales. Last year, the Minnesota Lottery sold 48 different versions of these games, offering customers a wide variety of themes from which to choose from. I am very pleased to share that in fiscal 2018, we set a new all-time high of over $411 million sold in scratch game sales. Our other product is lotto games. Now, these are games where players win by matching some combination of their numbers with numbers selected via a random drawing. Examples of lotto games include Powerball, Gopher 5, and Mega Millions. Fiscal 18 also saw strong lotto game sales, driven in part by sizable Powerball and Mega Millions jackpot runs, which I'm sure we all heard about the latter part of the year. At year's end, sales of lotto games exceeded $185 million. I am honored to report that thanks to the support of our players in fiscal 18, our total sales reached $600 million. That was a record for the Minnesota State Lottery. Record sales means the lottery delivered on our mission to support our beneficiaries. And as you can see by this slide, we were able to contribute back to the state $145 million. There are many contributing factors to these excellent numbers, and just three that I really want to highlight. One is our dedicated and forward-thinking staff. Secondly, a creative mix of scratch games that included successful partnerships with high-profile brands like the Minnesota Vikings, Bowl North, and social media superstar Grumpy Cat. And then finally, an award-winning marketing campaign featuring the tagline, "I'm in." It is also gratifying to see the stewardship of the LCCMR and the Minnesota Legislature has resulted in the value of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund surpassing $1 billion. The trust fund is a primary beneficiary of lottery proceeds that has been put to work in every single Minnesota county. many LCCMR supported programs would absolutely just not exist today without the funding generated by the Minnesota Lottery. Our retail partners are represented by the stars on the map and are located across the entire state of Minnesota. The lottery is a significant contributor to many local economies in Minnesota. The lottery works closely with these 3,000-plus brick-and-mortar retailers who sell our products. In fiscal 18, lottery retailers received almost $36 million in commissions for selling lottery products. In fact, kind of a fun fact for you, two of our top three retailers this past year were actually located in the city of Moorhead, serving both Minnesotans and our friends in North Dakota. To more appropriately compensate our retail partners, in July of 2018, which is the beginning of our fiscal year, we put in place a promotional rate increase to 6% on scratch ticket sales and 1.5% on cashing commissions. We felt this was an important step to strengthen the relationship between the Minnesota Lottery and our retail partners. As a result of the rate increase, retailers have received an additional $1.7 million in commissions over the past 6 months, which really is a win for both the retailers and for the local economies. We have begun a rulemaking process to make these changes permanent. We make sure our pursuits as well as our priorities are in line with those of the governor and you, our legislative partners. We are proud of the lottery's accomplishments. However, we are also working to proactively address some challenges the lottery will face over the next few years, including workforce changes and marketplace changes. Regarding our workforce changes, like many state agencies, the lottery has a large number of legacy employees. The responsibility and knowledge held by employees who will soon become retirement eligible is critical. Our focus is to properly address team needs in the future. Doing this right will help ensure the lottery is able to continue driving results. The state workforce has also become more diverse. To keep up with this change, we are working to ensure we are a more welcoming place to work and inclusive of all Minnesotans. We are also expanding our outreach to find talent that reflects the diversity of our great state. With regard to marketplace changes, the Minnesota Lottery primarily operates as a business to benefit the state. To remain effective, it is important we remain viable in an ever-changing marketplace. We must connect with adult millennials and more casual players. To support this, we design products and craft messages that appeal to new audiences. We must also have the tools that our younger customers expect. That includes properly addressing the increased popularity of digital payments. While the lottery remains primarily a cash-based operator, to remain competitive as our players shift to other payment tools such as Apple Pay, Venmo, or even digital currencies like Bitcoin, we must review these tools as well. But I think I should be really clear here to clarify that we are speaking of non-credit-based tools, okay? Our strategy. I want to take a moment to highlight some strategies that we've used to drive our success over the last couple years. First, understanding our customers. By leveraging market research, monitoring sales, learning from our business partners, and listening to our players, we have grown. Number two, expanding our player base. Our goal is to sell a few tickets to a lot of players rather than selling a lot of tickets to a few players. In 2018, we expanded our player base, reaching more players in the 25 to 38 year age demographic and a more diverse population. Thirdly, designing lottery games that appeal to our players. One example worth highlighting is the lottery's partnership with a local Latino artist to design our Day of the Dead scratch ticket. which is a Hispanic-themed ticket. Our work with this artist allowed the lottery to reach out to and be directly involved with this community through related event sponsorship. Number four, working closely with our retail partners. They are essential to the lottery's ongoing success. And finally, supporting our products via innovative advertising, exciting and relevant promotions, and fun incentives. Our results. Now on this slide, which you can see, there are two graphs. The first one shows an increase in annual sales, as I talked about, to almost $600 million in 2018. And that's over, if you compare that going back to 2009, that's roughly about a 25% increase over that 10-year period. So those are pretty substantial results. The second graph looks at retailer compensation. And you can see that now our average retailer's annual commissions now exceed $12,000 per year. And I believe that's increased going back from 2009 of about $7,000. And so that's a substantial increase since that over that 10-year time as well. Our most important measure remains our ability to provide resources to the state to benefit all Minnesotans. These important funds are used to improve our lakes and rivers, save endangered species, and support many other activities to make our state's quality of life better. We are pleased to report that fiscal 2018, our contribution to the state was the largest in the lottery's 30-year history. While we are gratified with our success, the lottery team remains committed to doing better. You can be assured that we will continue to support our players and partners, work hard to position the lottery for strong future growth, remain leaders in our industry, and finally stay focused on raising funds that can be leveraged to have a positive impact on the lives of Minnesotans. Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, we'd like to share a short one-minute video. The lottery produced this to highlight one of the many great projects that benefit from the support provided to the LCCMR by the lottery.
Thank you.
The BP oil spill was the biggest oil spill that we've had to deal with in the continental United States. There were still Minnesota migrant wildlife species in the Gulf, and the ones that we felt were the most vulnerable were the common loon and the American white pelican. We received a total of $651,000 to study how this event might be affecting those two species. Loons that had been tested the year before that had no contamination had the oil and the dispersant in their systems. We're just now right on the verge of getting a settlement for the first 3 years of conservation work that could total as much as $6 to $7 million. Citizen involvement is going to be the biggest way where we can spread the word, not only for now, but for future generations. You might have a beautiful lake, but if it hasn't got the loons, that's not a special lake.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. With that, I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you for your presentation. We do have some questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of series of questions to maybe get a better clarity on your handout here, the playing our part, your fiscal report. I'm going to assume that you're going to echo what Mr. Barrett said, that lottery-type sales continue to increase when gas prices go down. I mean, I'm going to stipulate that that's probably generally what's happening.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative. I I have no evidence of that directly, so I'm going to just say I think that probably is reasonable.
Okay. I just, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I thought it was somewhat anecdotal, but on a more comparison approach and digging into kind of the workings of the lottery, if I could direct you to pages 20 and 21 in your handout, it talks about the games that you had, talks about the sales and revenues that had occurred, and also talked about the tickets that were sold. How many tickets on average, if you have that information, go unsold in any individual game? So, for example, in the first one that we see here, the 50 times the money, were there perhaps 1.5 million tickets and 1.1 were sold? Which ones weren't redeemed?
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be a tough one for me to get to. And the reason it's tough is because every game, we track every game slightly differently, so the amount of tickets that are even put out there is different for every game. And so we could get something like that, but I'd have to do some research on that.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And I only ask that question because it's been asked of me by people. Like, so do all the big winners get backloaded in this and so they can burn through all these lottery? And I said, no, I'm not speaking for the lottery, but I suspect that there's even distribution throughout the state. It's random and those kinds of things as part of the gaming process. Can you provide me with some assurance that I'm giving the right answer to people when they ask me that question?
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative, you are absolutely giving the right answer to that.
Thank you.
It is very random.
And then, Madam Chair, one more question.
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Page 19, the top retailers. And anybody who has asked me this question might get this and ask that question. Looks like out of the top 20 retailers in the state of Minnesota, most if not, not all, because there's some that are in other parts, East Grand Forks, I noticed out here. You mentioned in your presentation, Mr. Doty, Moorhead area. But it looks like a lot of those are in the metro area, which would make sense given population distribution in the state of Minnesota. But I also noticed that more than 50% of your top retailers come from one particular company. In the way of a large grocery retailer based here in the recently based here in the state of Minnesota, but again, that's anecdotal since they have a large portion of the market too, I suspect. But give you a chance to maybe comment on that as well.
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, you are absolutely correct. Both counts. Number one, you're right. I do believe that the population in a lot of ways dictates those overall results, so I would absolutely agree with that. And I will also say that the lottery's had a very, very strong partnership with Cub Foods. And so that I think that's played out in this list as well. But that's not to say that other chains aren't doing very well and we aren't working with them as well. But for whatever reason, we've had a really good relationship with Cub over the years. And some organizations are more accepting of the lottery and the processes that we have to bring in, and so Cub has been very accepting to that. So it's been a great partnership.
Representative O'Driscoll. He's all done. Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I must be getting old because a scratch-and-win game called Day of the Dead has no appeal to me at all, so I just must be totally out of it. My first question is for nonpartisan staff, and if they could just maybe email this to me after the committee. The compulsive gambling funds, those finance accounts, where those are housed at, if you could just let me know what on the presentation here, there's a dedicated compulsive funding, compulsive gambling accounts. If you could just let me know what department, you can give me to this after, I have a couple questions. So number one will be where are those housed at, number two, the source of those funds in terms of appropriation, and three, the quantity of them in the last biennium. And you can just email them to me afterwards. With regards to a question for the our testifiers, recently the Department of Justice had a new interpretation of the WIRE Act. Can you talk about the consequences or lack of consequences in terms of its interaction with online purchases, or I don't know how to phrase it, like, there's lottery tickets that are getting bought online. The interaction from the department of how that's going to be impacting that.
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative, the DOJ's recent ruling has obviously been a big discussion point within the entire lottery industry. I think Right now, to best answer your question, we're not sure of what that impact is. There are some states, Minnesota's not one of those, where we are able to, some states are able to, people are able to purchase lottery tickets online, and so there's some really direct consequences there, if you will. Minnesota, we aren't able to do that, and so so for us it's a little different. But when you start digging into the DOJ's ruling, it's more than just the purchasing of tickets online. I mean, it's also the transmission of data and across, you know, across the internet, and that impacts all 47 lotteries across the country. And so there is a significant push right now to address the concerns that are raised in that ruling right now. So we still just don't know. We have two trade associations that the lotteries are part of. Minnesota is no exception to that, and both are writing their own opinions to make those opinions very much known in Washington over the next couple weeks as well.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. The opinion that is illegal must be news to the young resident of from Minnesota who won $1 million buying a scratch or buying a lottery ticket online last year. So that's must be news to him. So if you want to comment on that, perhaps,
Mr. Doty,
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes. So that young man purchased a ticket through a lottery service business, which is not the lottery, not connected directly to the lottery, and so yes, I'm sure that individual would be surprised to see what that ruling says.
Absolutely. And Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, you know, no surprise here, I'm going to ask a question about sports gambling. Sorry. So, you know, recently, obviously, there's been a lot of movement with the Supreme Court decision last year on sports gambling. We see in other states, particularly Delaware, where their state lottery, I believe, administers the sports gambling operations that are in that state. In terms of the lottery's should the legislature grant it, the lottery's capabilities, facilities to administer such a program, what tools what resources you have available, what resources you would need in order to accomplish that? Can you just, in a loose sense, not in favor or against, comment on how the lottery may or may not be positioned to be able to sort of administer such a program should the legislature decide to legalize that?
Mr. Sure. Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I think the best way for me, first let me start off by saying, again, this is an area that obviously we're looking closely at, but we don't have an opinion on specifically. So I want to start by saying that. I think that the way to answer your question for us really depends on the model that is going to be put forward that if this is granted, that will be agreed upon. There are probably about 8 or 9 states in addition now to Nevada, that including Delaware, like you're saying, that have allowed sports betting to happen in their state. And in most of those states, the lotteries are participating with sports betting. And in some cases, they do it in more of a parlay-type style, in fact, you heard Mr. Barnett talk about that a little bit earlier in terms of the parlay cards, and that can be done through our retail network that we already have set up. Our systems right now are set up where if we were able to do that, and we are working with an outside vendor that already administers through our system, our back office efforts, we would be positioned to take on additional responsibilities in that area. It would require a kind of a retooling a bit, but it would not be out of the realm of what we could possibly do right now. In terms of resources, the lottery takes no appropriations of any sort, and I would foresee that if that were to become the case, I would not see there be a need for any additional resources that would be provided. We would utilize the resources that we already have in the work that we do.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, can I ask one more quick question?
Yes, sir.
Just to the testifier, thank you for your answers. Can you disclose to me who that vendor is that you're discussing, or is that not public information? I wasn't aware that there was a vendor that provided the service you described.
So,
Mr. Duggy.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a vendor that provides our the lottery's back office operations, helps us with that. And that vendor is IGT. And there's no secret there. It's they help us. They manage our cash, all the other pieces of our work that we do.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And following up, actually, on your line of questioning with regard to online sales, so if somebody is operating online sales of the Minnesota Lottery in Minnesota, they're doing it outside the law. Is that what you're stating, Mr. Doty?
Yes.
Madam Chair, this has been a tough area for us a bit. I will say right now, organizations that are conducting business online, like you're describing, we believe are operating by virtue of a statute that is already in place. And that is something that we have no regulatory responsibility for, or are not part of that at all. And so I guess to directly answer your question, I don't have an opinion specifically on whether that is illegal or not. All I know is that they believe that they are operating within the statute.
Thank you for that, and I think it might be worth following up, and perhaps House Research could be willing to help us follow up on that particular statute that they're operating and getting some additional clarity. Do we know what statute they're operating under, or?
Maybe.
I believe it's
299. And if you could introduce yourself for the record, thank you.
Adam Prague, Madam Chair. I believe it's 299L, but I can get you that really quickly.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Broke your microphone.
And you fixed it. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the distribution of winning tickets the same in every deck of cards for a particular game?
Mr. Dunn?
Madam Chair, Representative, no. It would be different for each of the different games.
Okay, but within a game, would the distribution of winners be the same within a deck?
Mr. Dunn.
Madam Chair, no, it would be different for each game is going to have a different distribution of winners depending on, because I mean some games have more winners than others, and so it just depends on the game and how the game was, the profile of the game was originally established.
Representative Elkins?
No, that wasn't the question I asked.
So, okay, I'm sorry.
So if you, for just, let's just pick a game, Win Big.
Okay.
Retailers get decks of scratch game cards. Does every deck that a retailer gets have the same, for that game, the same distribution of winners as every other deck for that game that another retailer might get?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
No.
Mr. Doty.
No.
Fourth time.
Representative Elkins?
No, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just really not sure even where to begin on this. My first question is, a couple of years ago, the committee was surprised when all of a sudden we were going to buy lottery tickets at the gas pump. Mm-hmm. And we went through all that, could slow me down from reaching my Amway meeting on time, and I was very disturbed by that. That's bad enough, but then we go into this non-binding memorandum of understanding where clearly the online gaming is illegal. There's no question about that. And we can just go through the statute if you'd like. Mm-hmm. For example, it has to be a retailer, it has to be bricks and mortars, they can't resell. The contract, can't be transferred or signed. The director shall require that lottery tickets may be sold by retailers only for cash. I mean, I can just go down a list of how illegal what they're doing is at this point.
And Representative Davids, could you tell us what statute you're saying?
Yeah, that would be, subdivision 5, where is it here? Well, you just go to the... I can forward it here to you.
Thank you.
I just, well, I don't know I'll, if I'll get to you. Oh, I do. I'm not just making
okay.
this one up
I know
like
you're
I usually
not.
Do. Yeah. That being said, my first question, Madam Chair, to Mr. Doty is about June 1st or July 1st. Do you have any more surprises for us? Anything else you're coming at us with that this legislature has not approved?
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess my answer to that would be no. I'm not aware of surprises that we have provided to this legislature up to this point as well. So I'm not. My answer to you would be no.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Doty. Madam Chair, there were two big surprises. Buying lottery tickets to the gas pump was a big surprise to this committee. And a lot of times these things are done after we leave session. And then to go on entering into this non-binding memorandum of understanding, breaking, I figure, four laws. In fact, I could share with the committee my letter dated, let's see, where they're here somewhere. I believe it was July of 18 that goes into specifically where the statutes are being violated. So this discussion will be going on throughout the session. But I guess my biggest thing right now is I just don't have any more surprises June or July of 19. We just don't need that because the pay at the pump was a blind side to this committee, and the online sales being done illegally was a blind side to this committee. And so this discussion will continue, but clearly I can go down the list of the violations of law and what's being done with the jackpot one and whatever the other one was.
Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, it's statute 349.06, the lottery retailer statute subdivision 5. Is where you can clearly see that the law is being broken and violated in this case.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Mr. Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative. So first, I think I got to decide how to answer your question. So first of all, I think it's really important that I make clear that what the lottery service businesses, these organizations are doing has nothing to do with the lottery itself. Okay, I need to make that very clear. They're not part of the lottery. We are not working directly with them. They are operating as they believe within the statute, and they believe they're operating within the way the law has been set up. I think that there is clearly room for that to be debated, and I think that that's something that there's need for some further clarification on. But that is not the lottery. I want to also say, because the lottery has no regulatory authority over these types of industries, but they are facilitating lottery transactions, it was important for us to do something to make sure that we could protect the citizens of Minnesota. So the non-binding memorandum of understanding that we entered into with the two largest lottery service businesses was to do just that. It was to provide some basic rules of the road, if you will, in Minnesota, making sure you're not selling to underage individuals. All the things that are basic to making sure the basic integrity in the transactions. But beyond that, That was all that we did, and we felt that was all we could do, given relative to our position to these organizations.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, okay, so the lottery is innocent here, but you signed a non-binding memorandum of understanding that does violate statutes. So maybe you're not doing it, but you're having someone else do it. For example, a contract issued under this section may not be transferred or signed. In effect, that's what you've done. The director shall require that lottery tickets may be sold by retailers only for cash. That's not how they transact their business. So maybe you've pushed it off on them, so maybe you're lily white and squeaky clean, but what's going on violates statute.
Yes.
Maybe if I may just provide some clarity. I believe the model by which they use, and again, this is not the lottery. We didn't invite them here. We actually notified committees that they were coming. It sort of blindsided us as well, and we entered into this non-binding agreement to say, listen, here are some rules of the road. We don't have any regulatory authority, but if you're going to do it, here's what we'd hope that you'd go by. As far as the cash business, they actually are purchasing tickets from a retail, from a lottery vendor. So they're going to a brick and mortar place. It's a lot like Uber Eats, where you push a button on your phone and say, I want McDonald's, and someone drives to McDonald's and buys it from McDonald's and delivers it to you. You push a button on the phone. They believe they're authorized under 299L as a service business to drive to
a brick-and-mortar location and purchase a ticket for you, and then they scan the ticket in and send it back. The lottery doesn't have anything to do with them. We don't have regulatory authority over them.
Well, Madam Chair, and to the gentleman that just spoke, how does the person buying the ticket from this illegal organization, how do they pay for it? Do they pay cash?
I believe so. I've never downloaded the app because it would be illegal for me to do so. But it's my understanding that they do something online, whether it's PayPal or Venmo or some service. And I honestly don't know the answer to that.
And if I may, and Representative Davids, I know could I ask Joel Carlson to come down? It sounds like he has some additional information for the committee.
Madam Chair, you can do whatever Davids. You'd like.
And, well.
In this committee, she can do whatever she likes.
It's a very small place. Please introduce yourself for the record, and if you could address Representative David's questions.
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. And one of the companies I represent is called Auto Lotto, and they do business as lottery.com. They are a lottery service business. It's a statute that was passed by the legislature in 2005 that was carried by then member Paul Thiessen, now Supreme Court Justice Paul Thiessen. And what it does is it allows companies to manage lottery tickets for consumers. It's perfectly legal. It is done appropriately, and I appreciate that. Well, Mr. Doty doesn't have direct regulatory oversight over lottery service businesses. We do have regulatory oversight. It's done by the Department of Public Safety. Prior to establishing this business, I've represented this company for a number of years. We've met with the Department of Public Safety. We met with our regulators. We found out how it would be done right. It's done legally. It's done with a cash basis. The tickets are actually purchased directly from a lottery retailer, and they hold that for you. And what we've found is, not to sing the lottery's praises, but what we have found is that this is how people do almost everything, whether it's sports gaming or lottery or anything else. And this is the way that people interact with the lottery in many states, and it's perfectly legal to do that. And I want to say only as it relates to draw games. This does not apply to any kind of instant games or anything like Representative Davids was talking about as it relates to buy at the pump. That's not what's going on here. It's only the draw games that are authorized by statute 299L, and that's the only games that we participate in. And we've been operating in Minnesota maybe 18 months. I know we met with the previous chair. We met with the state government finance chair, and we've had interactions with the lottery who came to us and said, you're operating, and we want to be able to know how that's going to go on. And so while this memorandum of understanding is non-binding because they don't have statutory regulatory authority, this is how the lottery would like to see it done. And we've really engaged in that process because it's open and transparent, and we want the lottery to know, and they want to know what we're doing. Our retailer partner in this enterprise is in Manoman. It's our partner is the White Earth Indian Tribe is our retail partner, and it's open for inspection. In fact, we had a trip by the lottery that was canceled, and I know Director Sincotta is looking at going up there and looking at their operation as well. But it is not illegal, it is not improper, and it's certainly authorized currently by the statute. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative David, follow up.
Well, this discussion will continue. I sent a letter back, I believe it was in July of 2018, that brought out several points as to why this is not appropriate, and I will supply that to each committee member.
Thank you, Representative Davids. While you're at the table, Mr. Yes. Carlson, so this was described as Uber Eats for a lottery. The difference between Uber Eats and the lottery is that there's an age limit for who can participate in the lottery. So how do businesses like this verify ages and yep. know who they're selling to?
Yep. That's an excellent question. Madam Chair and members, as we have gone through this process with the, with DPS, and as we've explained to the lottery, we have an age verification system. It is all done on an ACH ACH basis for collecting cash prior to any purchase. We're comfortable that our age verification is good and location verification. It's not just age, it's location. Like any other, I will be deficient, Madam Chair, and tell you that I can't explain. Maybe Representative Garofalo can explain all of the processes of how you go about verifying someone's age online when they sign up through an application. But it's done, and that's what they comply with.
Thank you. I think Representative David's right. We'll probably keep discussing this, but appreciate the additional information.
Well, and Madam
and
Chair,
Representative Davis.
Thank you. They're using a statute that was written back in, I believe, in 2005 for some other business, and they found it, and there's a little loophole there, and they're driving a big semi through it, and I think the legislature should put a stop to it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Well, any additional questions? All right. Thank you for the presentation, Mr. Doty. And we have one more presentation from Tom DePasquale from the Minnesota Racing Commission. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. And thank you for inviting us to testify before you today. It's because of the line of questioning that we just heard that I brought my General Counsel, Patty Sifferly, with me today. And my Deputy Director would be here as well, but he's en route from warm weather climate. So I see some familiar faces and some new faces. So. On behalf of the Commission, we look forward to working with you on policy issues that affect the Commission and the racing industry in general in Minnesota. You have the now out-of-print 2017 annual report to the legislature and the governor that we issue each year by February 15th. So this year's report is on its way to the printer, and you'll have it shortly. And that summarizes pretty much, there's a constancy to the information that's contained in that annual report. I've supplemented it with finance information from the 2018 fiscal year, and I'll discuss that shortly. In broad terms, the MRC's roles are to ensure the integrity of horse racing and card playing in Minnesota, to oversee the proper distribution of funds back into the industry through the administration of the Breeders' Fund, and to provide for the safety and welfare of the human and equine participants. The commission is comprised of nine commissioners appointed by the governor for six-year terms. We're now acting with eight commissioners due to the unfortunate passing of our chair, Ralph Strangis, last year. So the acting chair is Mr. James Lane. Over the last few years, the commission's staffing has been relatively constant. We have 12 and a half full-time equivalents, but we have created new positions over the last few years to better match our human resources to the regulatory needs of the Commission. That includes the first-ever General Counsel of the Racing Commission, as well as a staff auditor who oversees the flow of funds through the industry and is responsible for ensuring adequate internal controls. And we also added another full-time investigator at Canterbury this last season to increase our presence on the backside and expedite licensing of industry participants. Of course, the staff expands during the racing season because we've got detention barn people who are involved in the testing of horses, veterinary staff and administrative support, and of course the racing officials themselves, the stewards and judges at the tracks. For those of you who are new to the racing oversight, we have two licensed tracks, the Canterbury Park and Running Aces. We issue over 5,000 occupational licenses each year to everybody involved in the industry. That includes the racing participants, employees at the tracks, and virtually anybody who is involved in providing goods and services to the tracks. We conduct 2,500 drug tests each year on horses that are involved in racing. We conduct almost 9,000 pre-race veterinary inspections, so no horse races at either track without being inspected the morning of the race by a commissioned veterinarian, then observed in the paddock prior to the race, and then followed around the track to ensure their safety until they're back home in their stalls. We issue about 200 rulings a year for rules violations. We conduct financial audits of the card room activities and the flow of money through the industry, and of course we officiate the races. MRC does not receive general revenue funds. In other words, the regulation of racing in Minnesota, as in most states, is entirely funded by the industry, although it's notable, and I mention this because it is the Commerce Committee, that other states are beginning to provide significant support for the horse racing industry through various means. You may be aware that the New Jersey legislature just passed a $100 million subsidy for their horse racing industry to promote breeding and increase purses at the track. And no, I'm not asking for $100 million. I'm just taking note of the fact that through various means, whether it's casino wagering, card rooms, sports betting, or direct subsidies to the industry, the states are beginning to recognize that there's a significant economic benefit to their racing industries, and they are in competition with other states' racing industries in order to attract the best horses, the best jockeys, trainers, drivers, etc. In fact, the commission does play a role in promoting the racing and breeding industry in Minnesota in order to provide that economic stimulus. We've shared with you back in 2016 an economic impact study that was done at our request by the University of Minnesota Mankato Extension. And that report showed that the racing industry and breeding industry has an over $400 million impact, economic impact in the state of Minnesota. That footprint is likely to increase in coming years because if you've been by the tracks lately or have watched what's going on there, both tracks are spending significant money for capital improvements. Running Aces has a hotel under construction on its property, and that hotel will be very full during the racing season and even outside the season because it's very close to where the new PGA Tour event is held, to the Blaine Soccer Stadium, and it's right off 35E where they're doing all the construction and expanding that bridge at the exit there. So that's going to attract a lot of activity. And Canterbury Park, which has had a large acreage undeveloped for many years, now has a development project underway for housing, residences, entertainment, and they're becoming a real destination in the Southwest metro area for entertainment. Turning to the MRC's finances, I've included in your packet a two-page preview of what will be in the 2018 annual report. And as I said, the funding of the commission comes directly from the industry, and there's many types of inputs into the commission's budget, primarily through licensing. The Class B licensees that you see there are the racetracks themselves. They pay an annual license fee, which is a relatively constant throughout the years. The Class C licensing represents occupational licensees, the 5,000 or more people and vendors that I mentioned. Each pay license fees in accordance with our rules, and those fees too have been relatively constant, which is an indicator that the industry growth has been relatively flat over the years. The spike in 2017 is attributable to the advanced deposit wagering bill that was passed and the license fee of $10,000 per provider, and that caused a spike of $60,000 or $70,000 in our annual license revenue there. The reimbursement accounts were authorized by the legislature to charge back to the tracks the costs of medical testing of the horses, which is $250,000 a year or so, the cost of veterinary services that are provided by commissioned vets at the tracks, and the cost of oversight and regulation of the card rooms. And those amounts are billed monthly to the tracks, and we keep in close contact with the tracks financial people so they can anticipate what's coming in the reimbursement accounts. The advanced deposit regulatory fees came online after the passage of the legislation in 2016, and you can see that the 1.25% annual regulatory fee that those ADW's providers pay to the commission has significantly enhanced our revenue stream. That money is used to defray the expenses of administering the Breeders' Fund to the extent of a quarter of a percent, and the 1% goes into the commission's operating budget. So turning to the outflows on the second page, this is basically divided into the pie chart, four segments, the most significant of which is staff compensation. It's made up roughly half of the commission's expenditures for a significant period of time, and it's staying at 48% this year as well as last year. That includes the 12 and a half full-time equivalents, about two dozen or more seasonal employees who come on board during the racing season, and it includes benefits, of course, for the state employees. The second largest chunk is contracted services. That's 35%, and those are the veterinary services, the equine testing through our industrial lab in Colorado, and the stewards and judges. Thirdly is the state-provided services at 11%. That's up from 8% last year, and that's attributable to increased costs due to a contested case that we had before the Office of Administrative Hearings. So the Attorney General had charged back of costs there, as well as the hearing examiner at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Also in that chunk is the financial and human resource support that we received from the Small Agency Resource Team, which is a very valuable assist to the Commission. And finally are the operating costs, the day-to-day supplies, travel, and expenses incurred by the Commission. Despite the fact that the Minnesota racing industry has enjoyed positive trends in recent years, and we have outperformed other states in terms of maintaining and enhancing the growth of Minnesota racing, there are significant challenges for the industry itself. As you know, horse racing is underexposed in the local media compared to other sports, and the soon-to-be-expanded sports market in Minnesota with the PGA Tour event, the new soccer stadium, and other competition for the sports entertainment dollar, racing faces a challenge in how to continue to gain share. The tracks here do a fantastic job of attracting fans. 90% or more of all parimutuel wagering in the United States is conducted off-track by people not present at the racetrack. That trend is different in the state of Minnesota. Canterbury and Running Aces, if you've been out there, always attract good crowds. Other than the Minnesota Twins in the summertime, Canterbury probably has the largest attendance of any sporting event in the state. And they do a great job of hosting events and making fans comfortable and teaching them about racing. The other thing that's notable is the purse enhancement agreement between Canterbury Park and the Midwakanton Tribe. This was a commercial agreement entered into in 2012 to provide purse enhancements for thoroughbreds and quarter horses at Canterbury Park. That agreement is due to expire in 2022, and there are negotiations right now to extend that agreement, and the Commission is hopeful it will be extended. To give you an example, the purse fund at Canterbury would be about $6.5 to $7 million per year without that purse enhancement, and with it, it's well over $14 million a year. And that makes Minnesota racing very competitive with other Midwestern outlets of similar size. Just to conclude, I know I'm going to be asked about sports wagering, so I might as well address it. I'll start by saying that the commission itself is agnostic on this. We have studied it intensively. I attend national meetings of the racing industry where this is topic A. And in all 38 racing states, it's the same as here. It's a source of both worry and hope. It represents a significant, perhaps even existential threat to the well-being of the racing industry and the competition for the wagering dollar. At the same time, it offers opportunity and upside potential for the racing industry is being realized in those states that have authorized sports betting and also have horse racing. And we're tracking developments in those states very carefully. I view our job as a regulator and the other regulators that are here today to inform your policy judgment, and we intend to continue to study the issue, and once we consult more in depth with the governor's office, we'll be available to meet with you and hopefully testify and provide some support in terms of policy judgments that you have to make in the coming years. So with that said, I look forward to continuing our positive relationship with the legislature. And I should say we have a bill that's already been dropped yesterday. It's really last year's bill that got vetoed through the omnibus finance bill. We also have a bill that we hope to get in the hopper in the next couple of weeks that's more substantial and carries very important changes to our enabling statute, and I'll probably be before you again to testify about that. So, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there questions? Or have the questions been preempted? Representative Garofalo, well, Representative Dean.
Sorry. Very quickly, Madam Chair, that's one form of preemption that you can support, isn't it?
Well played. Representative Dean.
I'm not sure how to follow that, but I will do my best. A quick question, Director DePasquale. Have the card rooms, I mean, what portion of revenue are they generating as compared to horse racing? And then an additional question is, you know, the track is being used for a lot of other things other than horse racing. And I'm curious, does the Racing Commission earn any sort of revenues from those type of events, whether it's a concert, whether it's, I'm just going to say it, selling hot tubs or whatever? I mean, is that sort of outside the purview of how the track interacts with the Racing Commission, or is there a relationship that allows revenues to flow as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, in terms of the revenue flow, we don't derive any revenue from other events that the tracks host, whether they be concerts or giraffe racing or whatever the case may be. They bring people in, and to the extent that they increase crowd attendance and paramutual handle, it benefits the industry, but the Commission derives no independent revenue. For vendors of goods and services that are present on the track for more than 4 days or more than 11 calendar days, we license them. We don't license people to come in just for a short event, typically.
Any follow-up?
Nope. Well, Madam Chair and Director, if you could speak to the what's happened relative to the card rooms.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And the impact on the bottom line for the track as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Dean. The card rooms, as you know, were authorized in 1999. As a means of generating money for purses. And in fact, the enabling statute has an unusual paragraph in it that says that if the commission believes at any time that the card rooms are not serving their purpose, which is the legislatively directed purpose to enhance purse funds, we should come to you with recommendations for change. I can tell you right now they do that. Running Aces derives about 80% or more of their revenue from their card room. And Canterbury, it's probably close to that amount. The tracks, and speaking for Running Aces, the track does not make money conducting a paramutual horse race meet. They subsidize the horse racing with the card rooms. And this is no different than a lot of states. Those are expensive establishments to run. They're large. They require a lot of capital investment, a lot of employees, a lot of regulatory compliance and cost overlays. As you can see from the license fees each year, they already start about $1 million in the hole or more. So the card rooms are essential to the ongoing health of the racing industry in Minnesota.
Thank you. And we're coming up on the end of our time here. I appreciate your time today, Mr. DePasquale. And if you have additional questions, I'm sure people will, yes, find you. Thank you very much. Just take a minute and say thank you to Representative Stevenson for chairing the meeting last week and your first time chairing. I did get to listen to it, listen to the audio, and I did want to just address one thing that was brought up, and that was some concern about the seniority of people serving on the Commerce Committee. And just want to say I don't know that we've ever had a seniority test to serve on the Commerce Committee. I started serving as a freshman, and just want to reassure everybody and make sure that everybody knows that the people who are serving on this committee are of high caliber and high levels of experience in issues that really are important to this particular committee, everything from securities to real estate to building to healthcare financing and small business and more. So I don't want anyone to misconstrue the fact that people who might not have a lot of experience in the legislature don't have a lot of experience outside the legislature, and everybody who has a seat on this committee is equally able to contribute. So I just wanted to make that clear, because I'm very excited about the experience that everybody who is sitting around this table brings, and look forward to working with you all. Thanks. With that, we're adjourned.